Good evening, everyone. It's Tom Mantione, Managing Director of Wealth Management, the Shantz Mantione Group. I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight. I'm excited to be here with everyone. Andrew Shantz and I have been providing wealth management together for over 22 years. That might seem like a long time. It is to me. We need, however, to go back even longer than that to get to his graduation date from the University of Delaware's Agricultural School, where he earned a BS in entomology. Yes, the study of bugs. He did a little postgraduate work in evolutionary biology, where he was in a field counting tree hoppers with long hair and a machete. Maybe he even drank a beer or two along the way. All of that obviously led him to a successful career in wealth management. Welcome, Andrew. Andrew and I are joined tonight by Nicole D'Onofrio, professor of plant pathology at the University of Delaware. Are you seeing a trend, or rather a lot of blue hens? Nicole was recently appointed a rotating program director at the National Science Foundation, which, by the way, is a pretty big deal. There's a few of you out there that think she has your dream job. I like her because she has a Bob Dylan lyric as her email signature. Welcome, Nicole. Also with us tonight is the man who has the dream job for another group on the call, Jeff White, the first CEO of Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, not named Ken Grossman. Jeff has been in the beer business a long time, spending 18 years at Boston Beer Company, where he held the title of COO, did a four-year stint at Miller Coors, and as luck would have it, or not, he is also a blue hen, having, I believe, a master's degree from the University of Delaware. Coincidence? Maybe not. Welcome, Jeff. Now I'll turn the evening over to my colleague, Andrew Shantz. Andrew, take it away.
Thanks, Tom. And thanks to everyone joining us tonight. I first have to mention that my wife, Andrea, also a blue hen, is my co-host. And for those joining our video call, you can see that we have two product placements tonight, some lovely Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, and also the University of Delaware. I especially want to thank Dan Sarkazian, Senior Director of Development for the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, as well as the College of Health Sciences at UD, for helping us put all this together. It's a quick serendipitous story. Dan and I were having a conversation in my office pre-COVID when we started connecting some dots and found out that one of the professors at the Ag School at Delaware was doing something really cool. And that was Nicole D'Onofrio teaching fermentation science. Coincidentally, Nicole and I went to high school together way back in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Won't say how many years ago that was, but it was interesting to me that Nicole was running this program focused on fermentation. And we're going to hear all about that tonight. Tom and I have hosted many virtual events during quarantine. Some of them have been intellectual capital events. Some of them have been fun things like wine tastings and chef events. This is great because we get to combine both things. So we're going to start with Nicole, and she's going to talk about the science of fermentation and what it is that we're getting when we actually are drinking these great products, and talk about the program at the University of Delaware. And then we're going to bring in Jeff White from Sierra Nevada. And I'm on Tom's side here in saying that Jeff has one of the greatest jobs in the world. And we're going to have a broader conversation together about the current trends in beer, fermentation, kombucha, all these things that are happening right now. With that, again, thanks to everybody on the call. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Nicole. And with that, Nicole, I turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks to Andrew and Tom, Jill and Margaret. Jeff, I feel like I'm sort of crashing a party here. Thank you so much to everybody for, you know, getting me involved in this. It's great. So I'm going to share my screen here with everybody. As Andrew said, I think Tom said it first. I am a plant pathologist, but we did get into fermentation sciences at University of Delaware. They don't have a program or a major per se, but my colleague Dallas Hoover and I, we started this class about 8 years ago. We both like tiny, tiny things that do important things, like bacteria that make cheese and yeast that make beer and bread and things like that. So I guess more in the microbiology side of it is a good way to put it. So today I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about what has gone on in the brewery at University of Delaware. And brewing in general is a little bit of magic, a whole lot of science, but mostly it's cleaning. We're not going to talk about the cleaning today. Jeff will back me up on that, I am sure. So we're going to be doing a bit of a brewing overview with a focus on fermentation. I'm going to hit you with a little bit of biochemistry, but don't be scared. I'll try to make it as seamless as possible. And I'll interweave it with some pictures of students and me in Dallas and some guest brewers and stuff in the brewery. So let's get started. Well, you're all here because you fall into this group. People like beer. So why do we care about this? Why are we having events like this? Why do we decide to make a fermentation sciences class at University of Delaware? People like fermented things. And one of those things is beer. So in 2019 alone in this country, there were over 8,000 craft breweries. That was a 4% increase from 2 years prior, over 500,000 jobs, and about $83 billion in wages and benefits just in the craft brewing industry alone. Some of these websites are great if you want to take a closer look, and they're easy to remember, beerinstitute.org, brewersassociation.org. In Delaware alone, Delaware brings in, the craft brewing industry brings in close to $400 million a year and employs 200 people directly in the breweries with 2,600 in related fields. We make about 300,000 barrels of craft beer per year. And as of last year, there were 23 breweries in our little teeny tiny state. So even Delaware is very much a fan of the craft brewing industry. But what we're going to talk about now is kind of how we get from A to Z, really, the desired product. And what you do when you brew is you have to really start backwards. You have to start with the style that you want to make. And more than that, you have to understand what the style is, what the target style is that you want to make. So how do we get to our desired end product? If you want to make a pale lager, it's really good to understand that you shouldn't use a highly roasted, very, very dark malt and lots of hops to do that. Your beer will come out very weird and it won't hit the style at all. And if you use a brewing calculator, then it will yell at you that you've completely messed up. So you have to know things like, okay, is it more on the malty side or more on the hoppy side? What kind of body does it have and finish? What kind of bitterness does it have? How much hops do you need to put in? So you really have to understand the target that you want to aim for. And more than that, you have to be able to truly define it if you want to kind of hit your style. All right, so here's our audience participation part. You can type your answers in the Q&A box and either Tom or Andrew will yell them out, I think. So tell me what the four main ingredients in beer are. I know we can get a little wild and put orange peel and things like that in there, but what are really the four? I'm looking for the four big ones. So go ahead, take a minute, have a sip of your beer and take a minute. Then when you start seeing answers, Tom or Andrew, just
hops. We got hops. We've got water, hops, yeast, and barley.
Love it.
Barley, hops, and water.
Okay.
Great. Hops, grain, water, and yeast.
Okay. Grain is good. Grain can count that.
Spam, baked beans, and spam.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's not right.
Water, hops, yeast, and barley.
Okay.
So hops, malt, awesome. Water, and yeast. So
awesome. I think, mostly y'all are getting it right. That's it. You nailed it. So the malt, which is barley, it's simply just germinated barley. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. Hops, yeast, and water. Here they are in all their glory. So the hop is the female cone of the plant, these beautiful little structures here. And then we have a plate full of differently roasted malt, barley malt. And then we have a very, very magnified picture of budding yeast, the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the workhorse of the microbial world. Okay, now let's do another Q&A, though, and this is my last Q&A. So type it into the box. For those of you who know your German beer history and are like German beers, there's something called a German purity law. I'm going to butcher how we say this, Reinheitsgebot. That's probably incorrect, but the Germans were really, really strict about their beers back in like the 1300s and 1400s. So does anyone know which of those four things you just mentioned doesn't actually fit in the German purity law? Type it into the Q&A box. You have a 25% chance of getting it right and a 75% chance.
And by the way, we got three different answers first coming in. So we have water, yeast, hops.
Okay.
And then we have straws. Straws is probably chicken stock. That's a new one.
My brother, probably, or my husband.
Water. So no one said barley yet, but
that's okay. We'll stop right there. Somebody said yeast.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations. Whoever said yeast got it right. So the three things that were allowed to be in beer in Germany during that time was barley, hops, and water. And that's pretty much because we didn't have a whole lot of microbiologists with microscopes running around at the time and really understanding that these microbes were the things doing the work, the things doing the actual fermentation. Natural flora like yeast and bacteria and stuff like that were coming in on the hops and on the grains and doing that work, but nobody really knew it at the time. So yeast does not tick the brief for the German purity law. But now we know a lot about yeast. We have all different kinds of styles. There are companies dedicated to this. So we use it very liberally at this point. All right. So moving right along. Thanks for playing along, everybody. So yeah, yeast is kind of left out of the German purity law, but we appreciate it for what it does for us. It gives us fermentation, which results in carbonation of the beer, results in flavors of the beer. Bananas in Hefeweizen don't come from bananas. They come from different strains of yeast and the clove flavors as well. And most importantly, for brewers, for some people, it gives us the alcohol that we have in our fermented beverages. So I like this definition of yeast. It's a gregarious, single-celled organism whose first evolutionary priority was to develop the capacity to synthesize alcohol, usually well-behaved, but can become rowdy in group. So what I'm going to do now is kind of walk you very quickly, because I don't have a lot of time, through the brewing process using this little diagram here and pictures of former students and guest brewers in the brewery. So just remember that a brewer's job is to make a happy home for the yeast so it can do its job, which is to make the beer. And we're going to talk about how we do that in over the next few slides. So you have to start first with the malt. There are two main goals of malting barley. The first goal is to get a stable source of enzymes so that you can convert complex carbohydrates into simple sugars. I don't know if any of you have gnawed on barley grains ever, but they are not sweet. They are full of complex carbohydrates, and yeast can't eat them. They can't metabolize them. They can't break them down. They need simple sugars as their food source. So how do we do this without buying a bunch of enzymes from Sigma Chemical and dumping them in to our big vat with water and grains in it and stuff? Well, we take advantage of this idea of malting. And the second goal of malting is to get aromas and flavors of the finished product. So all malting is essentially is germinated barley seeds. So here they are up top. And I don't know if y'all can see my mouth or not. If you can't, that's fine. It's pretty simplistic. And down here we see in this person's hands the malted barley. So, and all you can see are these little hairs right here. Well, that's the plant trying to get out and do what it naturally does, which is reach the light from the soil. So it's germinated, it's malted, okay? And now here comes the biochemistry. So everybody just stay with me. It's all going to be okay. So this word right here, this fun word, it's not that scary. It's long. So purification, the first part of it we can break down into saccharine or sweet, okay? So basically what that means is the breaking down of complex carbohydrates or the conversion found in these cereal grains into simple sugars that the yeast can eat, the yeast food, if you will. So what we've got in here is a cross-section of a barley seed. Here's the head of barley. Here's sort of a longitudinal section of it. And most of it is this very highly starchy endosperm layer. And that's chock full of these long, complicated, complex carbohydrates. So the yeast is like, no, can't do that. Can't do much with that. But what happens in the natural process of plant seed germination is the plant itself, the seed itself, starts to release enzymes that break down this starchy endosperm layer into these, and the enzymes are there to help provide food for the little plantlet to break through the soil and reach the sunlight. Let's all please remember this important point. It doesn't do this so we can enjoy beer. This is simply a natural process that we have taken advantage of so that we can go from complex carbs into glucose, this simple sugar, and through this biochemical pathway of the breaking down of sugar into pyruvate and the funneling of pyruvate into the ethanol fermentation pathway and the production of, with the release of carbon dioxide and the final product of ethanol, okay, or alcohol. So that's it. That's all the biochemistry. Bye-bye, biochemistry for now.
Nicole, can I just jump in there for a second and say,
yeah, of course.
I might have actually passed organic chemistry if you'd been my professor at that time. Oh. So unfortunately, that's where our paths diverged. Okay, go ahead.
Well, that's awfully kind of you. Thank you very much. I actually really liked organic chemistry, but don't ask me anything about analytical or physical chemistry because I won't be able to answer. All right, so here we are in the process. And before we can put those grains, those malted grains together with our brewing water, we have to crack them first, or at least we should crack them first, because what that does is it exposes more of that starchy endosperm layer to the water, okay, in order to release the enzymes. Everything has to be done at the right temperature. So here we are in the brewery at UD on the farm, and there's Gin White in the background. He was a guest brewer. Here's two of our brew crew members, Jenna and Drew, and here's Dallas Hoover over here, sort of my partner in crime in terms of teaching the class and the brewery, and another student from a few years back. And what you can see here in Gin's hand is after we pour all of the grains through the malt mill, you can see the perfect sort of texture. It's important to crack the grains to show more of this endosperm layer. Because when we get to the mash, which you can see Jenna is doing right here, and over in this picture, here's Riley, another member of the brew crew, and Alex Vanderleck, who's a head brewer at our craft brewery near in our town, Iron Hill. So he came in and guest brewed with us a few times. So what Jenna and Riley are doing is someone's pouring in those cracked grains, the malted grains, into water that's been prepared. It's been readied for whatever style it is we want to make. So we can put different varying amounts of salts, acids, bases into it, depending on our desired end style, depending on the grains we're putting in. Very, very darkly kilned grains, like for porters and stouts, are going to be highly acidic. They're going to drive the pH of the water down, and you're going to have to counteract that somehow. So your pH is really important for those enzymes that we just prepared by malting the barley and exposing the surface area. The pH is really going to matter for those enzymes to sort of wake up when they hit that perfect temperature water, become active, start saccharifying. There's that scary word again, breaking complex carbohydrates into simple sugars. All right, so a couple more terms about the mashing process. The mash temperature is going to target certain enzymes you want. So if you talk to Gin, he will give you a very complicated mashing temperature profile to make hefeweizen. But boy, can he make a good hefeweizen. The mash out involves raising the temperature to stop this enzymatic process. You can check how much conversion of complex carbs to simple sugars you've gotten by simply scooping out a little bit of that mash slurry from your mash vessel and putting a drop or two of iodine in there. If starch remains, it will turn purple. When all the starch is converted to sugars, there's no more purple. And then sparging is simply running hot water over the grain bed to make sure you've extracted all of those great sugars from your mash after you've done all that hard work. So once you get everything into the boil kettle, it's really important to add your hops. And even if you're making a beer that's not very hoppy, you probably want to put some hops in there for things like flavors and aromas. Hops are historically put in there for the purpose of keeping beer very microbiologically stable. We don't want any bad guys contaminating our beer after all the hard work that we've done. So here are some we use pelleted hops in the brewery. This is Joe, a former student from a few years ago, holding how we put the hops into these little mesh bags so they don't sort of clog up the wort when we're putting the boiled wort, the sweet wort, into the cooling vessel. And we control the boil. So we like a nice rolling boil, not too crazy. We don't want it boiling over, of course. And then at the very end of the boil, we create a whirlpool. This will help break down bad flavors that can be a problem for your finished product. And it will help kind of mix everything together as well. So when you add the hops, the hoppier you want your beer, the longer you're going to leave your hops in the boil for. So a 90-minute Dogfish Head IPA, those hops have been boiled for 90 minutes. There's a lot of chemistry that goes on in the boil kettle that I don't have time to get into, but I'm certainly happy to do that later. A little bit of the chemistry is shown on this slide. This is the major player in the world of that sort of bittering characteristic of India pale ales, okay? The alpha humulone that comes from the phenyl cone of the hop. So that gets shifted around a bit during the boil and gives that bittering characteristic. So moving along, we've boiled the wort. And now it should taste very sweet. It should kind of taste like the inside of a malted milk ball, a little bit like that, if you're familiar with that taste. And now you've got to do things very quickly. Okay. You've got to cool down the wort and you've got to give it some oxygen. So remember, our job as brewers is to make a happy environment for the yeast. In order to do that, we do want yeast to grow when we first pitch it in there. So we've got to give it some oxygen. It wants oxygen. I know fermentation is, you know, an anaerobic process, no oxygen, but yeast needs it in order to grow when you first put it in there. So if you've done your mash correctly, you'll have lots of sugars. You worked hard to do this. Don't blow it at the final stages. You got to cool it and aerate it quickly. And once again, let's just remember that brewers make the wort, not the beer. Yeast makes the beer. So here's our little workhorse friend, and here's all the biochemistry that these little factories, these little amazing teeny tiny factories do for us. And just to give a little more credit to the yeast that does the work, Saccharomyces cerevisiae is really the workhorse of the ale world, makes a lot of ales. Saccharomyces castoreanus makes your lagers, if you're a lager fan. And there are different species of Brettanomyces that will give you sour beers, lambic beers. So if you enjoy fruity or sweeter beers, you like the lambic. Saisons, that sort of barnyard or horsey aroma, okay, to those types of beers. So with that, sort of good to end on the yeast, because the yeast does the work, okay? The yeast makes the beer. I'd like to just then thank a whole bunch of people. I'd like to first start by thanking the Dean of the College of Ag and Natural Resources at UD, Mark Rieger, for funding the UD Brewery. Here's a picture of the brew crew here, and the brew crew consists of Riley Davis, Drew Ciccione, who's now a co-owner of a new brewery right up the road from here in Delaware, Jenna Castronis, Thomas Moran. I'd like to thank Dallas, my sort of co-professor, co-partner in crime on this whole journey. Gin White and Terry Mead built the brewery, and Justin and Alex from Iron Hill for all their help and time and patience. Andrew, Tom, Dan, Jeff White, thank you for letting me sit in on this and share a little bit of what I know from the brewing world. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We have one, Nicole, that was phenomenal. I never knew that chemistry could be so entertaining. I also wasn't really sure. Now I understand the allure of the University of Delaware because you have a brew crew.
We didn't always have a brew crew. That's relatively recent. And of course, we sadly couldn't have one this summer.
Nice job in creating that. I've never had a malted milk ball before. But I was surprised to see that only one town in Bavaria made a third of the crops. That just seemed bizarre to me. Yep. And it was one really great question. So is there a beer analogy terroir for wine? Meaning, you know, will a beer's ingredients have the same characteristic flavor of an environment that they come from?
So actually, there are a couple studies on this. There aren't a lot that I found, but we wanted to do exactly this. And we got funded. We got a little internal funding grant to do it, to look at, it's a very hard word to say, terroir of beer. And so we have our hops, we have genes that we've targeted in the hops from, we collected some from Vermont. Well, they were shipped to us from Vermont and from Washington State and from Delaware, because we grow hops on the farm as well. And we're going to look at those. The idea is Drew is going to extract nucleic acid from those and look at gene expression of genes that make of the biosynthetic pathway that makes those alpha humulins, those alpha acids that give the bittering qualities, and then relate it to the weather conditions during that year in that area. So terroir, of course, is also the soil. And we also, you know, we're planning on doing some phytochemistry on these hops as well. That, of course, took a little bit of a backseat to the pandemic stuff. So, but it's coming. We have the funding until next summer. So hopefully we'll get it done.
Great. Sorry, Drew, back to you.
No, that was a great question. And obviously, anyone along the way who has questions, please, you know, use that Q&A box. Thank you, Nicole. That was really fantastic. Now I'd like to bring Jeff White into the conversation. We had a conversation a few weeks ago that was pretty wide ranging in this topic. So we'll keep track of the time, but there's certainly a lot to talk about. As Tom mentioned, Jeff's now running the operations on Sierra Nevada, taking over from the founder. And, you know, we've got a bunch of specific questions to talk about, Jeff, but the first one is, how did you get this awesome job?
It's got to do with karma and former lives, I think. There's nothing I did this one. No, I've been in the industry a long time. I started in craft beer in the early 80s and just did a bunch of stuff. And, you know, you've heard this before. I always aspired to work for Sierra Nevada, not just because of the amazing quality of the beer, but because what the company stands for and the type of person that is Ken and the family. And I tried a couple of different times, and it wasn't the right time. And this last time, the timing was right. And I certainly never dreamed of being the CEO of Sierra Nevada. I just wanted to get a job there. I did. And then lo and behold, this happened. So a lot of good luck. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I said that all wrong. It's because of my graduate degree from the University of Delaware, College of Sciences. That's how I got the job.
Exactly.
I didn't include that answer. I'm sorry.
Okay. It's okay. We'll have plenty of time to plug the ag school. And a fun, quick aside, my children noticed one day that my diploma, as is Andrea's, from the University of, from the College of Agriculture. And the three of them scampered up recently and said, "So you went to college to be a farmer?" And we told them, of course, yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, why would we not? So that's an awesome thing. You know, the other thing I wanted to mention when you talk about Sierra Nevada being a great place to work and be affiliated with, and I'm looking at the label on the bottle and in fine print at the bottom. I don't know if anyone else has noticed this. I love that it says family owned, operated, and argued over.
Mm-hmm. Literally true.
You know, in more of a wide ranging sense, when we think about kind of when I think about the history of beer, the history of brewing in this country, going from sort of a pre-prohibition phase to a post-prohibition phase, I can remember when I was a kid, you know, grandparents having beer can collections, right? From beers, that beer seemed to be a very, very local thing. And that seemed to have prevailed for a while, leading into a period of time when one of the greatest movies in the history of the United States was filmed, Smokey and the Bandit, talking about trying to get Coors across the Mississippi to Georgia. And then, you know, then things changed for a while. And then there was, you know, independent or craft beers. And now, it's, you know, as Nicole pointed out, there's 8,000 of them. What's the dynamic there? How does that all happen?
I'd say the biggest stimulus to all that was Jimmy Carter making home brewing legal. So that was in the late 70s. Yeah. But, you know, so like a lot of businesses historically, you know, there were a lot of beer is always a family business and beer distributions are family businesses. But scale sort of took over and there are real advantages to scale, especially early on in terms of distribution. And Anheuser-Busch was one of the sort of the leaders of that. So scale took over. People started buying competitors or very aggressively putting competitors out of business. Prohibition didn't help. Which shut down lots and lots and lots of them. But everything about the beer industry was geared to scale. And in the U.S., beer had moved from the traditional family recipes that came over to really, and it's hard to talk about that, I'm not being judgmental, but it's sort of to a least common denominator, almost indistinguishable style of beer, the American Pale Lager, which is a perfectly fine beer and incredibly popular and refreshing. But though people love the brand differences between Budweiser and Miller and all that, there's not a lot of product differences. So it became about marketing and it became about scale. And distribution was about scale and all of the equipment was about scale and knowledge was about scale. And the craft brewers, so home brewers started and then craft brewers started. And, you know, the story of Ken built his own equipment out of old dairy tanks and junk stainless steel that he could find. Because there was no equipment on a small scale. There were no suppliers on a small scale. So you had to sort of beg and borrow grains and hops and things. Even homebrew stores existed before brewing was legal. And so you could get supplies. But so what ended up happening was a brewer started making beer. People started buying it. And so this handful of small craft brewers, they got better at it. And the barriers to entry really just started to fall down. And you could make a decent living. Ken's original business plan was, if I get really, really successful, someday I can sell 5,000 barrels of beer, and I can make a good living doing that. We sell 1.1 million barrels of beer right now. And, you know, we're not that big in the beer industry, in the craft beer industry. So it really became, people got better at it. The craft brewers are a remarkable bunch of people. They don't really compete. They share and they enjoy each other. So information and learning got shared, equipment got shared, problem solving got shared. And it was this sort of giant club, really, that was trying to bring amazing brewing back to the U.S., or I shouldn't say it that way, bring variety back to beer. Equipment manufacturers and suppliers quickly jumped on board as overall large industry wasn't growing. And so their customer base really was not growing and they were looking for other opportunities. So the smart ones started doing things, either supplying ingredients on small scale, making equipment for small scale, and distributors looking for that new big thing that might happen. So it just sort of all coalesced. And to jump to the present, you know, for 30 some odd years, people said, wow, this can't go on forever, but it's going on forever. And then we had 8,000 breweries. And we have passed the tipping point. And in fact, we should, pressing, but we should see, even before COVID, we saw the number of breweries increasing, slowing, and the number of breweries going out of business increasing. And that seesaw, if you will shift and shift dramatically, magnified by COVID. And we will see a net decrease in brewers all through 2021, which is a bummer, but.
It was interesting. That was a question that had been submitted to us beforehand was, is this exponential growth going to continue? And obviously you've answered that and you know, the answer is probably no. Why is there such camaraderie? Why, you know, it's not just what I hear from you, you know, whether it's, you know, founders in Michigan or a lot of these different small ones, it's seen, and even with people who buy beer just to give it away to other people, especially some of these craft places.
Yeah, it's a little hard to explain, I think, or to understand. It's not easy to explain if I knew why. But I think one of the things that's really helped with craft beer, and is a little bit of the headwinds right now, is the people that make craft beer love craft beer. Now, you don't get into this business to get rich because it's a really bad idea. So you have a passion to get in it. And what happens is you love all craft beer and you think it's really cool when somebody else makes one. So you're kind of making beer for yourself and your friends happen to be craft brewers or craft beer fans. And so, you drink other. So we drink, everybody that makes craft beer in the business drinks other people's beers. And they talk about them all the time and they praise them all the time. And it's really a big family. And then the drinkers, they also just like, they're very promiscuous, right? So they drink all around because they want it. They're just really interested in it and they try them all. So it really was a lot about joy. It was also less about pounding a 12 pack of beer and more about drinking it and tasting it. And, you know, Nicole talked about all the different styles. People love to share their expertise and share all the things they've tried and the rarity of it. So there was a lot of fun and joy in craft beer. It's a lot of work, but again, you don't get in it if you don't enjoy it.
Yeah, well, it certainly looked like the people in the program at UD were enjoying themselves. And Nicole, I saw a very disturbing picture in one of the last ones where they were dumping the beer on the ground. Is that what happens at the end?
Well, it's not always what happens at the end. We had to dump a lot of beer because when it doesn't taste good, you dump it.
Oh, okay.
So that happens sometimes, and it just, you know, something goes wrong. Maybe the mash didn't work out right. Maybe your, you know, specific gravity, you didn't hit your specific gravity or something like that. Maybe gin wasn't there to help you make a proper Hefeweizen. So maybe you made it sour instead. So yeah, we've made our fair share of, you know, solid drinkable beers, I think, but we've made our fair share that we've had to dump down the drain as well. And sometimes we just need more room in the chest coolers. You know, Sierra Nevada, I'm sure must have big, glorious walk-in coolers that where everything is kept and chilled. And we have two chest freezers. So we don't have a whole lot of space.
We've also been known to dump some beer down again.
Okay.
It happens, right, Jeff? I mean, yeah. It happens to the best of us, right?
This is perfect.
So from your standpoint, being on the operations or holding so many different roles in
in craft. Nicole talked a little bit about beginning with the end in mind. And we also talked about, we're talking about science and technology. Where does that all come together at Sierra Nevada? Do you have a skunk work somewhere that's coming up with crazy things? Are you looking, are you more market driven and saying, hey, you know, all these hazy type of things that are out now, these IPAs are what everyone seems to be after. You know,
hey, watch it. Watch it. I'm drinking the hazy little thing IPA. Watch it there.
So how does that work for you guys? And well, we'll leave it there. And then I have a great follow-up as well.
Sure. You know, some things are happy accidents. So hazy, for instance. So when I started in the business, the brewer's job was to make sure it was not hazy. That would have been a problem. I have a great friend who was a brewer for a long time, and he brewed with me at New Amsterdam, but he's a lager brewer. He's retired now. And he talks to me about sour beers, which I love. And he's like, you know, I'd get fired if I made one of these things. My whole life was to make sure this never happened. So some of it is happy accidents. Some of it is intentional. What we have at Sierra Nevada, we have an R&D team. So by craft beer standards and really by large beer standards, we're makers, not marketers. Ken's fascination and obsession with beer is in the science and the making of beer and in fermentation. That's where his passion and his love comes from. And, you know, you got to sell it in order to be able to afford to try more things and get better toys. And I'm going to send Nicole some information on our labs. You'd be kind of blown away for a company our size, the type of equipment we have. But we do have an innovation group. And they work off two things. We do have a marketing team, and that marketing team gives some directions and insights of what trends are and consumers are, and gives them directions on things they'd like to see them do, whether it's market segments or specific styles. And then there's also a segment which we just call unconstrained innovation. They wake up in the middle of the night and go, coffee bean skins. I want to permit coffee bean skins because, you know, they either heard something or they came back from Peru and they want to make a chicha, and they just do whatever they want. And we take those things and we go, maybe people will like it, maybe they won't. We have a group of people inside our take-home group. We send a bunch of stuff home with people to get to work for the company. We have two restaurant pubs when COVID's not around that we get a lot of people in. We get about 1 million people a year through. We ask them what they think. So we do a bunch of both. As well as looking at trends and replicating trends. So you're drinking a hazy little thing, Tom. We have a wild little thing, which is a sour. And we just came out, which was competing with nobody. And then we just came out with the big little thing, which is an Imperial IPA. Because the two big trends in beer are lower alcohol and higher alcohol. So we came out with a higher alcohol one.
It's interesting that you say that, because we've had kind of the same question asked prior to us being live tonight, and then now it's been asked again, and I think you kind of covered it, but I'm going to try and rephrase the question a little bit. Do you guys at Sierra feel like the explosion of microbrewery hurts or helps your market share, regardless of the trend, right? I mean, how do you compete when there's, you know, 7,000 different microbrews out there? Is it helping or hurting?
Yeah, a little of both. So, and it's changed now with COVID, which is also a little of both, unfortunate. So we're beer had really started migrating in the last 4 or 5 years to a tale of two sizes. Two things that were really succeeding were very large, that had big marketing budgets and get distribution, and then this flock to local. My neighborhood. And again, the barriers of entry are so small that of those 8,000 breweries, most of them don't sell in bottles and cans. Most of them sell just direct to consumer over the bar with a glass. They're really small. But the people, not just in beer, but everything, there's a flight to local and personal. And so that's great for beer. And, you know, when people go out and they love beer, they can't always go to that brew pub. So when they go to the supermarket or the convenience store or whatever, and they want a great craft beer, that interest in beer fuels our sales. But you can't be local everywhere. And so when it became 8,000 of them, it's like those tiny, you know, a lightning bolt won't kill a tree, but a thousand tiny ants will eat through the bark and it'll kill a 100-year-old tree. So there was a bit of that. Unfortunately, with COVID, the vast majority of them, or I shouldn't say that, very, very, very many of them, are dependent on that over-the-bar direct-to-consumer sale. And that disappeared. And they don't have, like we do, supermarkets and chain stores that's nationwide. And so when that drinker stopped coming in, their cash dried up. And again, this is not a business where you make a ton of money and you go, oh, I'll just weather the storm. You're trying to weather the month half the time on good times. So they're all seriously challenged. And, you know, craft brewers being craft brewers, people are getting together going, I'll make some beer for you. I'll sell some beer for you. You know, I'll package it for you and you can sell it on e-commerce, but very difficult to do on a large scale. So part of the acceleration of the decline in craft brewers is going to be strictly COVID related. Because as it is right now, without PPP funds, I don't know how at least half of them made it 3 months. It's brutally difficult. And they won't come back, not for a while anyway.
Well, interesting question dovetailing with that, Jeff, from Dean Rieger. And thanks for joining us, Dean. In terms of what would you say to, given what you just said, what would you say to students that are still interested in brewing, not looking to get rich, but because it's something that they love? And what should they be studying and what experiences, this is a great question, what experiences should they be looking to seek out to kind of build their portfolio?
So I know Nicole's going to have a hard time with this answer, but I said it when we chatted, and I almost started my presentation with it. Fermentation science. Absolutely. So beer is just a really fun, really approachable, really mainstream way to learn and enjoy a fermented product. But fermentation is some sort of magic. Nicole can talk about it better than I can. But if you think about fermentation, it's beverages you enjoy, it's foods, it's medicine. Fermented foods and gut health are a huge piece of what we're going to be learning more and more. The mainstream world is going to be learning more and more about. So fermentation, so if I'm a student in that area, certainly beer is a great way to learn about it, but I would focus on being really smart and educated on fermentation and what fermentation can do, not just in liquid, but in everything. So that would be my advice to the school in terms of program, where to put your money. Beer is a great way to manifest that, but that shouldn't be the end. Because beer will come and go. You know, we also make a hard kombucha called Strange Beast. I should hold up a can now. and kombucha is interesting because it's also fermentation, but it uses a SCOBY, which Nicole can talk about more, but SCOBY is symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast, right? And so it's also intentional bacteria in there and non-alcoholic kombucha. Is known for its health properties. Alcoholic kombucha. Okay. Tastes really good. You can't advertise health properties in alcohol. And there's a question as to whether or not they last. But short answer, brewing is a lot of fun and it's a great way to learn, but you should be learning about fermentation if you want to really be on the cutting edge of what's going to be happening in a lot of ways in this country. One person's opinion.
I can't second that strongly enough, Jeff. Thank you. Yeah, we did talk about that on the pre-call.
No, we've only met each other once. So it's,
yeah. No, it's great. It's a great plug for that. And on the farm, and something that the Dean has really sponsored and gotten behind. And what we appreciate is that we do a lot of fermentation things there. We're making cheese too and mead with the honey from the bees on the farm. So all of these things could come together, coalesce nicely into a program.
You guys should make sauerkraut and pickles and all kinds of stuff.
That's great. That's just a great idea. I did take apiology there and I did keep bees at the University of Delaware. I'm not sure if Dewey Caron is still there, but he may have moved on. But I remember fondly my time with the bees. It's a very zen thing to do. You can't freak out when you're doing that. Jeff, you touched on something interesting, and just a few more. You talked about, quote, healthy beers or low-alc or non-alc beers and the kombucha. And you guys, I believe, invested in or bought Sufferfest, which is an enhanced beer, right? Would you talk about that a little bit and where you see that going?
Yeah. I'd like to see it going farther and faster than it's currently going. So Sufferfest is an interesting story. It started by a woman named Caitlin Landensberg, not a brewer, but an endurance athlete who was also gluten intolerant but didn't know what was wrong with her. So she had some serious gut issues and overall health issues. And after a lot of testing, found out that she was severely gluten intolerant, but she loved her beer. And so she wanted to create a beer that she could drink in her finish line product. And then as you started thinking about it, it's like, what else can I do to add to this beer to make it, you know, for people like me? And so trying to add things, you're not allowed to say health benefits and alcohol, but trying to add things that people that know would look at and go, oh, yes, I actually also take bee pollen. And look, there's bee pollen in my beer. So Sufferfest is very focused on the active lifestyle person. You know, it's not really, it's very difficult to talk about beer as a wellness drink because honestly, it's alcohol and that's not bad, but it's also, you know, difficult to call it wellness besides being illegal. So I didn't say it was, I was saying it was difficult. And so she's created, so Sufferfest beer is gluten removed. You can brew beer that's gluten free, but you can't use barley malt, for instance. And so you end up using things like oats, sorghum, rice, and it's difficult to make a beer. And as Nicole talked about, you know, getting the right sugar source is a little bit tough. So what we use is an enzyme, an organic enzyme, but an enzyme that binds to and pulls out the gluten. So it's not technically gluten-free, but it passes the threshold for celiac if you want to. So somebody asked earlier on in the Q&A, is there a burpless beer? Kind of depends on what you make to burp. I'm also gluten intolerant, which is really a trouble in my job. And it manifests in a couple of ways, including burping. And so for me, Sufferfest is a burpless beer. It's very small right now, and we're taking it slow.
Is it outside of California at all, or is it?
It is. It's primarily focused in California. COVID has had some really interesting challenges in trying to build brands because a beer like that that is unknown, you want to sample people on. You want to walk up and go, try this. And, you know, one of their beers, FKT, which stands for fastest known time, is brewed with black currant and salt. And it is this beautiful sort of ruby red beer with just, I mean, it may not sound good if you don't like black currant and salt, but I absolutely adore this beer. And I know if I can get it in the glass and get somebody to drink it, you just win people over every time. But you can't do that right now. You can't go to Whole Foods and set up a table and taste people. You can't go to the bar and buy him a pint. And so it's very difficult to do that. And so we're trying to find ways through, unfortunately, through social media and that type of thing to try to get people to try. So we're going to take a slow roll until we can really do it the right way.
Okay. Well, I got one more comment or question. I'd be interested in both of your comments. And when you talk about the future of fermentation outside of beer, and I, you know, we've talked a little bit about the difference between fermentation and distillation and where that puts some of these, I don't know if you call them all seltzers or clear products or exactly how you want to talk about them, but there's a lot of, it was called Zima back when I was younger, but now there's all these seltzers and things. Are those fermented products or distilled products? And, you know, where do you see them kind of going forward in terms of the science and you know, what's going on there?
So I'll jump in with a highly opinionated point of view, which does not represent my company's point of view necessarily. No, I should say, so I'm, you know, I'm an old craft beer guy. And so this art of creating beer and flavors and really chewing your beer and sipping it and just savoring it, it's kind of what craft beer has been. At the same time, you know, if you don't make, trying to convince people to buy what you make versus making what you buy, it's a tough road, right? So, you know, we're in business. So seltzers are extremely popular right now. And I don't think in my close to 40 years in the business, anybody has ever seen anything that grew this quickly. It's in over 3 years, it's 10%+ of the beer business. My issue is that people refer to it as beer. So Nicole talked about what the ingredients are in beer. Barley malt, hops, water, yeast. Most successful seltzers in the country do not have barley malt or hops. It's a sugar alcohol, sugar fermentation, not distillation, with flavors added. And honestly, sometimes those flavors, you can have up to 49% of the alcohol in your beer legally come from flavors. And those flavors can be made with spirits. But you can't just pour vodka in, but you can add lime flavoring that just happens to be highly alcoholic. So these are concoctions that have found a way to take advantage of beer's lower tax rate. They're also extremely refreshing, extremely easy to drink, relatively, once you have the recipe and tech down, pretty easy to make and make fast. So it's a great commercial product and it's very popular. So my issue with it is, to answer your question, it's fermented, kinda. A lot of them have a distilled aspect to it, but unofficially as a flavor.
Yeah, and I want to jump in there too, Jeff, and just ask you sort of follow up on that and say, isn't it like, I think the definition a few years ago anyway of being a craft brewery was that you could not make any flavored, you know, I think it was maybe hard alcohols at the time, maybe not even hard alcohols. You couldn't make anything like a Zima, you know, like that Andrew brought up earlier. You couldn't make it, you weren't allowed to make any of those things, or like a Mike's Hard Lemonade or something like that. Has that definition shifted to allow craft breweries to get into this? And do seltzers fall into that category? Or are they something, some different beast altogether?
Yeah, so they're not considered craft beers, but as a brewer, you're no longer excluded from the club if you make. So it used to be a certain percentage, vast majority of your production was what was a defined craft beer, traditional ingredients, no adjuncts, everything added for flavor. This is the Brewers Association. So this is craft brewers defining themselves. It's not a legal description. And I won't name names, but you know, some of the, and so the craft, the Brewers Association needs members, and it's got 8,000 of them, but most of them are teeny. And the big ones, the big one, more and more of their business became not craft beer, to the point where, naming no names, I believe 20% of, or less of their volume and revenue comes from beer. The rest comes from tea, seltzer, cider, all of which are not craft beer products. But it's okay now. So that definition used to be called microbreweries, and you couldn't be more than 1,500 barrels. And then they grew, and then it's like, okay, well, now, you know, what about the 30,000 barrel one? Okay, it's 30,000 barrels. Now it's 6 million barrels, which is not a craft brewery. It's a giant brewery. And there isn't anybody close. Again, we're like number two, and we're 1 million barrels, and we're a behemoth.
Well, I have to say that this has been one of the most interesting virtual events that we've done. And I really appreciate, Jeff, your time and spending some time with us, and Nicole, you as well. I'm really excited to see everything that's going on at the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Delaware. It's gone far beyond what it was many years ago when Andrea and I were there, and that's really wonderful. Again, want to thank Dan Sarkissian for putting us all together and helping us have these conversations. And you know, it's really been a treat to spend time with both of you and see the work that you're doing. So I can't wait next time we get down post-COVID, and we're out of this, and we can come down and take a walk around the farm again and see what's going on down there. And we will get out to California. So Jeff, hopefully we'll be able to try one of those fun new brands in the pub there.
Well, we have a big brewery in Asheville, North Carolina, so that's closer.
Yep. So Jeff, when you come there, you could just come right on up and visit us.
I have to come by.
Although, you come down there. Yes.
Understanding is Jimmy's Diner is no longer there, so I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do.
I don't know what that is.
Yes, it is no longer there. So.
Yeah.
Well, it is the Stone Balloon. So, or is that back now? I'm not sure.
Well, it's back in a different sort of form.
They did sell some beer there, I heard. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I want to say thank you to all of the attendees. And again, special thanks to our guests and Tom and Jill and Margaret who helped us out. And this has been really spectacular. Thanks to you both and have a great evening.
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you.
Hi, Nicole. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too, Jeff. Take care. Bye. Stay in touch. Bye. Bye.